Let us assure the listener now, and no doubt we shall do it again, that there is a world of difference between hindsight profits and real money profits. We doubt seriously whether the Chrysler type of roller coaster is a suitable medium for operations by our enterprising investor. We have mentioned protracted neglect or unpopularity as a second cause of price declines to unduly low levels. A current case of this kind would appear to be National Presto Industries. In the bull market of 1968, it sold at a high of 45, which was only 8 times the $5.61 earning for that year. The per-share profits increased in both 1969 and 1970, but the price declined to only 21 in 1970. This was less than 4 times the record earnings in that year, and less than its net current asset value. In March 1972, it was selling at 34, still only 5.5 times the last reported earnings, and at about its enlarged net current asset value. Another example of this type is provided currently by Standard Oil of California, a concern of major importance. In early 1972, it was selling at about the same price as 13 years before, say 56. Its earnings had been remarkably steady, with relatively small growth, but with only one small decline over the entire period. Its book value was about equal to the market price. With this conservatively favorable 1958 through 71 record, the company has never shown an average annual price as high as 15 times its current earnings. In early 1972, the price over earnings ratio was only about 10. A third cause for an unduly low price for a common stock may be the market's failure to recognize its true earnings picture. Our classic example here is Northern Pacific Railway, which in 1946 through 47 declined from 36 to 13.5. The true earnings of the road in 1947 were close to $10 per share. The price of the stock was held down in great part by its $1 dividend. It was neglected also because much of its earnings power was concealed by accounting methods peculiar to railroads. The type of bargain issue that can be most readily identified is a common stock that sells for less than the company's net working capital alone, after deducting all prior obligations. This would mean that the buyer would pay nothing at all for the fixed assets, buildings, machinery, etc., or any goodwill items that might exist. Very few companies turn out to have an ultimate value less than the working capital alone, although scattered instances may be found. The surprising thing, rather, is that there have been so many enterprises obtainable which have been valued in the market on this bargain basis. A compilation made in 1957, when the market's level was by no means low, disclosed about 150 of such common stocks. In Table 7-4, found on the enhancement, we summarize the result of buying. On December 31, 1957, one share of each of the 85 companies in that list, for which data appeared in Standard & Poor's monthly stock guide, and holding them for 2 years. By something of a coincidence, each of the groups advanced in the 2 years to somewhere in the neighborhood of the aggregate net current asset value. The gain for the entire portfolio in that period was 75%, against 50% for Standard & Poor's 425 industrials. What is more remarkable is that none of the issues showed significant losses. 7 held about even, and 78 showed appreciable gains. Our experience with this type of investment selection, on a diversified basis, was uniformly good for many years prior to 1957. It can probably be affirmed without hesitation that it constitutes a safe and profitable method of determining and taking advantage of undervalued situations. However, during the general market advance after 1957, the number of such opportunities became extremely limited, and many of those available were showing small operating profits, or even losses. The market decline of 1969 through 70 produced a new crop of these sub-working capital stocks. We discuss this group in Chapter 15, on stock selection for the enterprising investor. Bargain issue pattern in secondary companies. We have defined a secondary company as one that is not a leader in a fairly important industry. Thus, it is usually one of the smaller concerns in its field. But it may equally well be the chief unit in an unimportant line. By way of exception, any company that has established itself as a growth stock is not ordinarily considered secondary. In the great bull market of the 1920s, relatively little distinction was drawn between industry leaders and other listed issues, provided the latter were of respectable size. The public felt that a middle-sized company was strong enough to weather storms, and that it had a better chance for really spectacular expansion than one that was already of major dimensions. The Depression years, 1931 through 32, however, had a particularly devastating impact on the companies below the first rank, either in size or in inherent stability. As a result of that experience, investors have since developed a pronounced preference for industry leaders, and a corresponding lack of interest, most of the time, in the ordinary company of secondary importance. This has meant that the latter group have usually sold at much lower prices in relation to earnings and assets than have the former. It has meant further that in many instances the price has fallen so low as to establish the issue in the bargain class. When investors rejected the stocks of secondary companies, even though these sold at relatively low prices, they were expressing a belief, or fear, that such companies faced a dismal future. In fact, at least subconsciously, they calculated that any price was too high for them because they were heading for extinction. Just as in 1929, the companion theory for the blue chips was that no price was too high for them because their future possibilities were limitless. Both of these views were exaggerations and were productive of serious investment errors. Actually, the typical middle-sized listed company is a large one when compared with the average privately owned business. There is no sound reason why such companies should not continue indefinitely in operation, undergoing the vicissitudes characteristic of our economy, but earning, on the whole, a fair return on their invested capital. This brief review indicates that the stock market's attitude towards secondary companies tends to be unrealistic, and consequently to create in normal times innumerable instances of major undervaluation. As it happens, the World War II period and the post-war boom were more beneficial to the smaller concerns than to the larger ones, because then the normal competition for sales was suspended, and the former could expand sales and profit margins more spectacularly. Thus, by 1946, the market's pattern had completely reversed itself from that before the war. Whereas the leading stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average had advanced only 40% from the end of 1938 to the 1946 high, Standard & Poor's index of low-priced stocks had shot up no less than 280% in the same period. Speculators and many self-styled investors, with the proverbial short memories of people in the stock market, were eager to buy both old and new issues of unimportant companies at inflated levels. Thus, the pendulum had swung clear to the opposite extreme. The very class of secondary issues that had formerly supplied by far the largest proportion of bargain opportunities was now presenting the greatest number of examples of overenthusiasm and overvaluation. In a different way, this phenomenon was repeated in 1961 and 1968, the emphasis now being placed on new offerings of the shares of small companies of less than secondary character, and on nearly all companies in certain favored fields, such as electronics, computers, franchise concerns, and others. As was to be expected, the ensuing market declines fell most heavily on these overvaluations, In some cases, the pendulum swing may have gone as far as definite undervaluation. If most secondary issues tend normally to be undervalued, what reason has the investor to believe that he can profit from such a situation? For if it persists indefinitely, will he not always be in the same market position as when he bought the issue? The answer here is somewhat complicated. Substantial profits from the purchase of secondary companies at bargain prices arise in a variety of ways. First, the dividend return is relatively high. Second, the reinvested earnings are substantial in relation to the price paid and will ultimately affect the price. In a 5 to 7 year period, these advantages can bulk quite large in a well-selected list. Third, a bull market is ordinarily most generous to low-priced issues. Thus, it tends to raise the typical bargain issue to at least a reasonable level. Fourth, even during relatively featureless market periods, a continuous process of price adjustment goes on, under which secondary issues that were undervalued may rise at least to the normal level for their type of security. Fifth, the specific factors that in many cases made for a disappointing record of earnings may be corrected by the advent of new conditions, or the adoption of new policies, or by a change in management. An important new factor in recent years has been the acquisition of smaller companies by larger ones, usually as part of a diversification program. In these cases, the consideration paid has almost always been relatively generous, and much in excess of the bargain levels existing not long before. When interest rates were much lower than in 1970, the field of bargain issues extended to bonds and preferred stocks that sold at large discounts from the amount of their claim. Currently, we have a different situation, in which even well-secured issues sell at large discounts if carrying coupon rates of, say, 4.5% or less. Example, American Telephone and Telegraph, 2 5/8 due 1986, sold as low as 51 in 1970. Deere and Company, 4.5, due 1983, sold as low as 62. These may well turn out to have been bargain opportunities before very long, if ruling interest rates should decline substantially. For a bargain bond issue in the more traditional sense, perhaps we shall have to turn once more to the first mortgage bonds of railroads, now in financial difficulties, which sell in the 20s or 30s. Such situations are not for the inexpert investor. Lacking a real sense of values in this area, he may burn his fingers. But there is an underlying tendency for market decline in this field to be overdone. Consequently, the group as a whole offers an especially rewarding invitation to careful and courageous analysis. In the decade ending in 1948, the billion-dollar group of defaulted railroad bonds presented numerous and spectacular opportunities in this area. Such opportunities have been quite scarce since then, but they seem likely to return in the 1970s. Special situations, or workouts. Not so long ago, this was a field which could almost guarantee an attractive rate of return to those who knew their way around in it. And this was true under almost any sort of general market situation. It was not actually forbidden territory to members of the general public. Some who had a flair for this sort of thing could learn the ropes and become pretty capable practitioners without the necessity of long academic study or apprenticeship. Others have been keen enough to recognize the underlying soundness of this approach and to attach themselves to bright young men who handled funds devoted chiefly to these special situations. But in recent years, for reasons we shall develop later, the field of arbitrages and workouts became riskier and less profitable. It may be that in years to come, conditions in this field will become more propitious. In any case, it is worthwhile outlining the general nature and origin of these operations, with one or two illustrative examples. The typical special situation has grown out of the increasing number of acquisitions of smaller firms by large ones, as the gospel of diversification of products has been adopted by more and more managements. It often appears good business for such an enterprise to acquire an existing company in the field it wishes to enter, rather than to start a new venture from scratch. In order to make such acquisition possible, and to obtain acceptance of the deal by the required large majority of shareholders of the smaller company, it is almost always necessary to offer a price considerably above the current level. Such corporate moves have been producing interesting profit-making opportunities for those who've made a study of this field and have good judgment fortified by ample experience. A great deal of money was made by shrewd investors not so many years ago through the purchase of bonds of railroads in bankruptcy. Bonds which they knew would be worth much more than their cost when the railroads were finally reorganized. After promulgation of the plans of reorganization, a when-issued market for the new securities appeared. These could almost always be sold for considerably more than the cost of the old issues which were to be exchanged therefore. There were risks of non-consummation of the plans or of unexpected delays, but on the whole such arbitrage operations proved highly profitable. There were similar opportunities growing out of the breakup of public utility holding companies, pursuant to 1935 legislation. Nearly all these enterprises proved to be worth considerably more when changed from holding companies to a group of separate operating companies. The underlying factor here is the tendency of the security markets to undervalue issues that are involved in any sort of complicated legal proceedings. An old Wall Street motto has been, "Never buy into a lawsuit." This may be sound advice to the speculator seeking quick action on his holdings. But the adoption of this attitude by the general public is bound to create bargain opportunities in the securities affected by it, since the prejudice against them holds their prices down to unduly low levels. The exploitation of special situations is a technical branch of investment, which requires a somewhat unusual mentality and equipment. Probably only a small percentage of our enterprising investors are likely to engage in it, and this audiobook is not the appropriate medium for expounding its complications. Broader implications of our rules for investment. Investment policy, as it has been developed here, depends in the first place on a choice by the investor of either the defensive, passive, or aggressive, enterprising role. The aggressive investor must have a considerable knowledge of security values, enough in fact to warrant viewing his security operations as equivalent to a business enterprise. There is no room in this philosophy for a middle ground, or a series of gradations between the passive and aggressive status. Many, perhaps most, investors seek to place themselves in such an intermediate category. In our opinion, that is a compromise that is more likely to produce disappointment than achievement. As an investor, you cannot soundly become half a businessman, expecting thereby to achieve half the normal rate of business profits on your funds. It follows from this reasoning that the majority of security owners should elect the defensive classification. They do not have the time, or the determination, or the mental equipment to embark upon investing as a quasi-business. They should therefore be satisfied with the excellent return now obtainable from a defensive portfolio, and with even less. And they should stoutly resist the recurrent temptation to increase this return by deviating into other paths. The enterprising investor may properly embark upon any security operation for which his training and judgment are adequate, and which appears sufficiently promising when measured by established business standards. In our recommendations and caveats for this group of investors, we have attempted to apply such business standards. In those for the defensive investor, we've been guided largely by the three requirements of underlying safety, simplicity of choice, and promise of satisfactory results, in terms of psychology as well as arithmetic. The use of these criteria has led us to exclude from the field of recommended investment a number of security classes that are normally regarded as suitable for various kinds of investors. These prohibitions were listed in our first chapter. Let us consider a little more fully than before what is implied in these exclusions. We have advised against the purchase at full prices of three important categories of securities. 1. Foreign bonds. 2. Ordinary preferred stocks. And 3. Secondary common stocks, including, of course, original offerings of such issues. By full prices, we mean prices close to par for bonds or preferred stocks, and prices that represent about the fair business value of the enterprise in the case of common stocks. The greater number of defensive investors are to avoid these categories regardless of price. The enterprising investor is to buy them only when obtainable at bargain prices, which we define as prices not more than 2/3 of the appraisal value of the securities. What would happen if all investors were guided by our advice in these matters? That question was considered in regard to foreign bonds, and we have nothing to add at this point. Investment-grade preferred stocks would be bought solely by corporations, such as insurance companies, which would benefit from the special income tax status of stock issues owned by them. The most troublesome consequence of our policy of exclusion is in the field of secondary common stocks. If the majority of investors, being in the defensive class, are not to buy them at all, the field of possible buyers becomes seriously restricted. Furthermore, if aggressive investors are to buy them only at bargain levels, then these issues would be doomed to sell for less than their fair value, except to the extent that they were purchased unintelligently. This may sound severe and even vaguely unethical. Yet in truth, we're merely recognizing what has actually happened in this area for the greater part of the past 40 years. Secondary issues, for the most part, do fluctuate about a central level, which is well below their fair value. They reach and even surpass that value at times, but this occurs in the upper reaches of bull markets, when the lessons of practical experience would argue against the soundness of paying the prevailing prices for common stocks. Thus, we are suggesting only that the aggressive investor recognize the facts of life as it is lived by secondary issues, and that they accept the central market levels that are normal for that class as their guide in fixing their own levels for purchase. There is a paradox here, nevertheless. The average well-selected secondary company may be fully as promising as the average industrial leader. What the smaller concern lacks in inherent stability, it may readily make up in superior possibilities of growth. Consequently, it may appear illogical to many listeners to term unintelligent the purchase of such secondary issues at their full enterprise value. We think that the strongest logic is that of experience. Financial history says clearly that the investor may expect satisfactory results, on the average, from secondary common stocks, only if he buys them for less than their value to a private owner, that is, on a bargain basis. The last sentence indicates that this principle relates to the ordinary outside investor. Anyone who can control a secondary company, or who is part of a cohesive group with such control, is fully justified in buying the shares on the same basis as if he were investing in a closed corporation, or otherwise private business. The distinction between the position, and consequent investment policy, of insiders and of outsiders, becomes more important as the enterprise itself becomes less important. It is a basic characteristic of a primary or leading company that a single detached share is ordinarily worth as much as a share in a controlling block. In secondary companies, the average market value of a detached share is substantially less than its worth to a controlling owner. Because of this fact, the matter of shareholder-management relations, and of those between inside and outside shareholders, tends to be much more important and controversial in the case of secondary than in that of primary companies. At the end of chapter 5, we commented on the difficulty of making any hard and fast distinction between primary and secondary companies. The many common stocks in the boundary area may properly exhibit an intermediate price behavior. It would not be illogical for an investor to buy such an issue at a small discount from its indicated or appraisal value, on the theory that it is only a small distance away from a primary classification, and that it may acquire such a rating unqualifiedly in the not-too-distant future. Thus, the distinction between primary and secondary issues need not be made too precise, for if it were, then a small difference in quality must produce a large differential in justified purchase price. In saying this, we are admitting a middle ground in the classification of common stocks, although we counseled against such a middle ground in the classification of investors. Our reason for this apparent inconsistency is as follows. No great harm comes from some uncertainty of viewpoint regarding a single security, because such cases are exceptional, and not a great deal is at stake in the matter. But the investor's choice as between the defensive or the aggressive status is of major consequence to him, and he should not allow himself to be confused or compromised in this basic decision. Commentary on Chapter 7. It requires a great deal of boldness and a great deal of caution to make a great fortune. And when you've got it, it requires 10 times as much wit to keep it. Nathan Mayer Rothschild. Timing is nothing. In an ideal world, the intelligent investor would hold stocks only when they are cheap and sell them when they become overpriced, then duck into the bunker of bonds and cash until stocks again become cheap enough to buy. From 1966 through late 2001, one study claimed $1 held continuously in stocks would have grown to $11.71. But if you'd gotten out of stocks right before the 5 worst days of each year, your original $1 would have grown to $987.12. Like most magical market ideas, this one is based on sleight of hand. How exactly would you or anyone figure out which days will be the worst days before they arrive? On January 7, 1973, the New York Times featured an interview with one of the nation's top financial forecasters, who urged investors to buy stocks without hesitation. "It's very rare that you can be as unqualifiedly bullish as you can now." That forecaster was named Alan Greenspan, and it's very rare that anyone has ever been so unqualifiedly wrong as the future Federal Reserve Chairman was that day. 1973 and 1974 turned out to be the worst years for economic growth and the stock market since the Great Depression. Can professionals time the market any better than Alan Greenspan? "I see no reason not to think the majority of the decline is behind us," declared Kate Leary Lee, president of the market timing firm of R.M. Leary & Co., on December 3, 2001. "This is when you want to be in the market," she added, predicting that stocks look good for the first quarter of 2002. Over the next 3 months, stocks earned a measly 0.28% return, underperforming cash by 1.5 percentage points. Leary is not alone. A study by 2 finance professors at Duke University found that if you had followed the recommendations of the best 10% of all market timing newsletters, you would have earned a 12.6% annualized return from 1991 through 1995. But if you had ignored them and kept your money in a stock index fund, you would have earned 16.4%. As the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard noted, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. Looking back, you can always see exactly when you should have bought and sold your stocks. But don't let that fool you into thinking you can see in real time just when to get in and out. In the financial markets, hindsight is forever 20/20, but foresight is legally blind. And thus, for most investors, market timing is a practical and emotional impossibility. What goes up? Like spacecraft that pick up speed as they rise into the Earth's stratosphere, growth stocks often seem to defy gravity. Let's look at the trajectories of three of the hottest growth stocks of the 1990s. General Electric, Home Depot, and Sun Microsystems. See figure 7.1 on the enhancement. In every year from 1995 through 1999, each grew bigger and more profitable. Revenues doubled at Sun and more than doubled at Home Depot. According to Valueline, GE's revenues grew 29%. Its earnings rose 65%. At Home Depot and Sun, earnings per share roughly tripled. But something else was happening, and it wouldn't have surprised Graham one bit. The faster these companies grew, the more expensive their stocks became. And when stocks grow faster than companies, investors always end up sorry. As figure 7.2 shows, a great company is not a great investment if you pay too much for the stock. Take a look for yourself on the enhancement. The more a stock has gone up, the more it seems likely to keep going up. But that instinctive belief is flatly contradicted by a fundamental law of financial physics. The bigger they get, the slower they grow. A $1 billion company can double its sales fairly easily. But where can a $50 billion company turn to find another $50 billion in business? Growth stocks are worth buying when their prices are reasonable, but when their price over earnings ratios go much above 25 or 30, the odds get ugly. Journalist Carol Loomis found that from 1960 through 1999, only 8 of the largest 150 companies on the Fortune 500 list managed to raise their earnings by an annual average of at least 15% for 2 decades. Looking at 5 decades of data, the research firm of Sanford C. Bernstein & Company showed that only 10% of large U.S. companies had increased their earnings by 20% for at least 5 consecutive years. Only 3% had grown by 20% for at least 10 years straight. And not a single one had done it for 15 years in a row. An academic study of thousands of U.S. stocks from 1951 through 1998 found that over all 10-year periods, net earnings grew by an average of 9.7% annually. But for the biggest 20% of companies, earnings grew by an annual average of just 9.3%. Even many corporate leaders fail to understand these odds. The intelligent investor, however, gets interested in big growth stocks not when they're at their most popular, but when something goes wrong. In July 2002, Johnson & Johnson announced that federal regulators were investigating accusations of false record-keeping at one of its drug factories, and the stock lost 16% in a single day. That took J&J's share price down from 24 times the previous 12 months' earning to just 20 times. At that lower level, Johnson & Johnson might once again have become a growth stock with room to grow, making it an example of what Graham calls the relatively unpopular large company. This kind of temporary unpopularity can create lasting wealth by enabling you to buy a great company at a good price. High potential for hype potential. Investors aren't the only people who fall prey to the delusion that hyper-growth can go on forever. In February 2000, Chief Executive John Roth of Nortel Networks was asked how much bigger his giant fiber optics company could get.
"The industry is growing 14% to 15% a year," Roth replied. "And we're going to grow 6 points faster than that. For a company our size, that's pretty heady stuff."
Nortel's stock, up nearly 51% annually over the previous 6 years, was then trading at 87 times what Wall Street was guessing it might earn in 2000. Was the stock overpriced?
"It's getting up there," shrugged Roth. But there's still plenty of room to grow our valuation as we execute on the wireless strategy. After all, he added, Cisco Systems was trading at 121 times its projected earnings. As for Cisco, in November 2000, its chief executive, John Chambers, insisted that his company could keep growing at least 50% annually. Logic, he declared, would indicate this is a breakaway. Cisco's stock had come way down. It was then trading at a mere 98 times its earnings over the previous year. And Chambers urged investors to buy. So who are you going to bet on? He asked. Now may be the opportunity. Instead, these growth companies shrank, and their overpriced stocks shriveled. Nortel's revenues fell by 37% in 2001, and the company lost more than $26 billion that year. Cisco's revenues did rise by 18% in 2001, but the company ended up with a net loss of more than $1 billion. Nortel's stock, at $113.50 when Roth spoke, finished 2002 at $1.65. Cisco's shares, at $52 when Chambers called his company a breakaway, crumbled to $13. Both companies have since become more circumspect about forecasting the future. Should you put all your eggs in one basket? Put all your eggs into one basket, and then watch that basket, proclaimed Andrew Carnegie a century ago. Do not scatter your shot. The great successes of life are made by concentration. As Graham points out, the really big fortunes from common stocks have been made by people who packed all their money into one investment they knew supremely well. Nearly all the richest people in America trace their wealth to a concentrated investment in a single industry, or even a single company. Think Bill Gates and Microsoft, Sam Walton and Walmart, or the Rockefellers and Standard Oil. The Forbes 400 list of the richest Americans, for example, has been dominated by undiversified fortunes ever since it was first compiled in 1982. However, almost no small fortunes have been made this way, and not many big fortunes have been kept this way. What Carnegie neglected to mention is that concentration also makes most of the great failures of life. Look again at the Forbes Rich List. Back in 1982, the average net worth of a Forbes 400 member was $230 million. To make it onto the 2002 Forbes 400, the average 1982 member needed to earn only a 4.5% average annual return on his wealth. During a period when even bank accounts yielded far more than that, and the stock market gained an annual average of 13.2%. So how many of the Forbes 400 fortunes from 1982 remained on the list 20 years later? Only 64 of the original members, a measly 16%, were still on the list in 2002. By keeping all their eggs in the one basket that had gotten them onto the list in the first place, once booming industries like oil and gas, or computer hardware, or basic manufacturing, all the other original members fell away. When hard times hit, none of these people, despite all the huge advantages that great wealth can bring, were properly prepared. They could only stand by and wince at the sickening crunch, as the constantly changing economy crushed their only basket and all their eggs. The bargain bin. You might think that in our endlessly networked world, it would be a cinch to build and buy a list of stocks that meet Graham's criteria for bargains. Although the internet is a help, you'll still have to do much of the work by hand. Grab a copy of today's Wall Street Journal, turn to the money and investing section, and take a look at the NYSE and NASDAQ scorecards to find the day's lists of stocks that have hit new lows for the past year. A quick and easy way to search for companies that might pass Graham's networking capital tests. Online, try http://quote.morningstar.com
http://highlow.html:m:section=capital H lowercase I lowercase g lowercase h capital L lowercase o lowercase w. To see whether a stock is selling for less than the value of net working capital, what Graham's followers call net nets. Download or request the most recent quarterly or annual report from the company's website or from the EDGAR database at www.sec.gov. From the company's current assets, subtract its total liabilities, including any preferred stock and long-term debt, or consult your local public library's copy of the Value Line Investment Survey, saving yourself a costly annual subscription. Each issue carries a list of bargain basement stocks that come close to Graham's definition. Most of these stocks lately have been in bombed out areas like high tech and telecommunications. As of October 31, 2002, for instance, Comverse Technology had $2.4 billion in current assets and $1 billion in total liabilities, giving it $1.4 billion in net working capital. With fewer than 190 million shares of stock and a stock price under $8 per share, Comverse had a total market capitalization of just under $1.4 billion. With the stock priced at no more than the value of Comverse's cash and inventories, the company's ongoing business was essentially selling for nothing. As Graham knew, you can still lose money on a stock like Comverse, which is why you should buy them only if you can find a couple dozen at a time and hold them patiently. But on the very rare occasions when Mr. Market generates that many true bargains, you're all but certain to make money. What's your foreign policy? Investing in foreign stocks may not be mandatory for the intelligent investor, but it is definitely advisable. Why? Let's try a little thought experiment. It's the end of 1989, and you're Japanese. Here are the facts. Over the past 10 years, your stock market has gained an annual average of 21.2%. Well ahead of the 17.5% annual gains in the United States. Japanese companies are buying up everything in the United States, from the Pebble Beach Golf Course to Rockefeller Center. Meanwhile, American firms like Drexel Burnham Lambert, Financial Corp of America, and Texaco are going bankrupt. The U.S. high-tech industry is dying. Japan's is booming. In 1989, in the land of the rising sun, you can only conclude that investing outside of Japan is the dumbest idea since sushi vending machines. Naturally, you put all your money in Japanese stocks. The result? Over the next decade, you lose roughly two-thirds of your money. The lesson? It's not that you should never invest in foreign markets like Japan. It's that the Japanese should never have kept all their money at home, and neither should you. If you live in the United States, work in the United States, and get paid in U.S. dollars, you are already making a multi-layered bet on the U.S. economy. To be prudent, you should put some of your investment portfolio elsewhere, simply because no one anywhere can ever know what the future will bring at home or abroad. Putting up to a third of your stock money in mutual funds that hold foreign stocks, including those in emerging markets, helps insure against the risk that our own backyard may not always be the best place in the world to invest. Chapter 8. The Investor and Market Fluctuations. To the extent that the investor's funds are placed in high-grade bonds of relatively short maturity, say of 7 years or less, he will not be affected significantly by changes in market prices and need not take them into account. This applies also to his holdings of U.S. savings bonds, which he can always turn in at his cost price or more. His longer-term bonds may have relatively wide price swings during their lifetimes, and his common stock portfolio is almost certain to fluctuate in value over any period of several years. The investor should know about these possibilities and should be prepared for them both financially and psychologically. He will want to benefit from changes in market levels, certainly through an advance in the value of his stock holdings as time goes on, and perhaps also by making purchases and sales at advantageous prices. This interest on his part is inevitable and legitimate enough, but it involves the very real danger that it will lead him into speculative attitudes and activities. It is easy for us to tell you not to speculate. The hard thing will be for you to follow this advice. Let us repeat what we said at the outset. If you want to speculate, do so with your eyes open, knowing that you will probably lose money in the end. Be sure to limit the amount at risk and to separate it completely from your investment program. We shall deal first with the more important subject of price changes in common stocks, and pass later to the area of bonds. In Chapter 3, we supplied a historical survey of the stock market's action over the past 100 years. In this section, we shall return to that material from time to time in order to see what the past record promises the investor, in either the form of long-term appreciation of a portfolio held relatively unchanged through successive rises and declines, or in the possibilities of buying near bear market lows and selling not too far below bull market highs. Market fluctuations as a guide to investment decisions. Since common stocks, even of investment grade, are subject to recurrent and wide fluctuations in their prices, the intelligent investor should be interested in the possibilities of profiting from these pendulum swings. There are two possible ways by which he may try to do this: the way of timing and the way of pricing. By timing, we mean the endeavor to anticipate the action of the stock market, to buy or hold when the future course is deemed to be upward, to sell or refrain from buying when the course is downward. By pricing, we mean the endeavor to buy stocks when they are quoted below their fair value and to sell them when they rise above such value. A less ambitious form of pricing is the simple effort to make sure that when you buy, you do not pay too much for your stocks. This may suffice for the defensive investor, whose emphasis is on long pull holding, but as such, it represents an essential minimum of attention to market levels. We are convinced that the intelligent investor can derive satisfactory results from pricing of either type. We are equally sure that if he places his emphasis on timing, in the sense of forecasting, he will end up as a speculator, and with a speculator's financial results. This distinction may seem rather tenuous to the layman, and it is not commonly accepted on Wall Street. As a matter of business practice, or perhaps of thoroughgoing conviction, the stockbrokers and the investment services seem wedded to the principle that both investors and speculators in common stocks should devote careful attention to market forecasts. The farther one gets from Wall Street, the more skepticism one will find, we believe, as to the pretensions of stock market forecasting or timing. The investor can scarcely take seriously the innumerable predictions which appear almost daily and are his for the asking. Yet in many cases he pays attention to them and even acts upon them. Why? Because he has been persuaded that it is important for him to form some opinion of the future course of the stock market, and because he feels that the brokerage or service forecast is at least more dependable than his own. We lack space here to discuss in detail the pros and cons of market forecasting. A great deal of brain power goes into this field, and undoubtedly, some people can make money by being good stock market analysts. But it is absurd to think that the general public can ever make money out of market forecasts. For who will buy when the general public, at a given signal, rushes to sell out at a profit? If you, the listener, expect to get rich over the years by following some system or leadership in market forecasting, you must be expecting to try to do what countless others are aiming at, and to be able to do it better than your numerous competitors in the market. There is no basis, either in logic or in experience, for assuming that any typical or average investor can anticipate market movements more successfully than the general public, of which he is himself a part. There is one aspect of the timing philosophy which seems to have escaped everyone's notice. Timing is of great psychological importance to the speculator, because he wants to make his profit in a hurry. The idea of waiting a year before his stock moves up is repugnant to him. But a waiting period, as such, is of no consequence to the investor. What advantage is there to him in having his money uninvested until he receives some presumably trustworthy signal that the time has come to buy? He enjoys an advantage only if by waiting he succeeds in buying later at a sufficiently lower price to offset his loss of dividend income. What this means is that timing is of no real value to the investor unless it coincides with pricing, that is, unless it enables him to repurchase his shares at substantially under his previous selling price. In this respect, the famous Dow theory for timing purchases and sales has had an unusual history. Briefly, this technique takes its signal to buy from a special kind of breakthrough of the stock averages on the upside, and its selling signal from a similar breakthrough on the downside. The calculated, not necessarily actual, results of using this method showed an almost unbroken series of profits in operations from 1897 to the early 1960s. On the basis of this presentation, the practical value of the Dow theory would have appeared firmly established. The doubt, if any, would apply to the dependability of this published record as a picture of what a Dow theorist would actually have done in the market. A closer study of the figures indicates that the quality of the results shown by the Dow theory changed radically after 1938, a few years after the theory had begun to be taken seriously on Wall Street. Its spectacular achievement had been in giving a sell signal at 306, about a month before the 1929 crash, and in keeping its followers out of the long bear market until things had pretty well righted themselves at 84 in 1933. But from 1938 on, the Dow theory operated mainly by taking its practitioners out at a pretty good price, but then putting them back in again at a higher price. For nearly 30 years thereafter, one would have done appreciably better by just buying and holding the DJIA. In our view, based on much study of this problem, the change in the Dow theory results is not accidental. It demonstrates an inherent characteristic of forecasting and trading formulas in the fields of business and finance. Those formulas that gain adherence and importance do so because they've worked well over a period, or sometimes merely because they've been plausibly adapted to the statistical record of the past. But as their acceptance increases, their reliability tends to diminish. This happens for two reasons. First, the passage of time brings new conditions which the old formula no longer fits. Second, in stock market affairs, the popularity of a trading theory has itself an influence on the market's behavior, which detracts in the long run from its profit-making possibilities. The popularity of something like the Dow theory may seem to create its own vindication, since it would make the market advance or decline by the very action of its followers when a buying or selling signal is given. A stampede of this kind is, of course, much more of a danger than an advantage to the public trader. Buy low, sell high approach. We are convinced that the average investor cannot deal successfully with price movements by endeavoring to forecast them. Can he benefit from them after they have taken place? For example, by buying after each major decline and selling out after each major advance. The fluctuations of the market over a period of many years prior to 1950 lent considerable encouragement to that idea. In fact, a classic definition of a shrewd investor was one who bought in a bear market when everyone else was selling and sold out in a bull market when everyone else was buying. If we examine our chart 1, covering the fluctuations of the Standard & Poor's composite index between 1900 and 1970, and the supporting figures in Table 3-1, we can readily see why this viewpoint appeared valid until fairly recent years. Between 1897 and 1949, there were 10 complete market cycles, running from bear market low to bull market high and back to bear market low. 6 of these took no longer than 4 years. 4 ran for 6 or 7 years, and 1, the famous New Era cycle of 1921 through 1932, lasted 11 years. The percentage of advance from the lows to highs ranged from 44% to 500%, with most between about 50% and 100%. The percentage of subsequent declines ranged from 24% to 89%, with most found between 40% and 50%. It should be remembered that a decline of 50% fully offsets a preceding advance of 100%. Nearly all the bull markets had a number of well-defined characteristics in common, such as 1, a historically high price level, 2, high price over earnings ratios, 3, low dividend yields as against bond yields, 4, much speculation on margin, and 5, many offerings of new common stock issues of poor quality. Thus, to the student of stock market history, it appeared that the intelligent investor should have been able to identify the recurrent bear and bull markets, to buy in the former and sell in the latter, and to do so for the most part at reasonably short intervals of time. Various methods were developed for determining buying and selling levels of the general market, based on either value factors or percentage movements of prices, or both. But we must point out that even prior to the unprecedented bull market that began in 1949, there were sufficient variations in the successive market cycles to complicate and sometimes frustrate the desirable process of buying low and selling high. The most notable of these departures, of course, was the great bull market of the late 1920s, which threw all calculations badly out of gear. Even in 1949, therefore, it was by no means a certainty that the investor could base his financial policies and procedures mainly on the endeavor to buy at low levels in bear markets and to sell out at high levels in bull markets. It turned out in the sequel that the opposite was true. The market's behavior in the past 20 years has not followed the former pattern, nor obeyed what once were well-established danger signals, nor permitted its successful exploitation by applying old rules for buying low and selling high. Whether the old, fairly regular bull and bear market pattern will eventually return, we do not know. But it seems unrealistic to us for the investor to endeavor to base his present policy on the classic formula. For example, to wait for demonstrable bear market levels before buying any common stocks. Our recommended policy has, however, made provision for changes in the proportion of common stocks to bonds in the portfolio, if the investor chooses to do so, according as the level of stock prices appears less or more attractive by value standards. Formula plans. In the early years of the stock market rise that began in 1949 through 50, considerable interest was attracted to various methods of taking advantage of the stock market cycles. These have been known as formula investment plans. The essence of all such plans, except the simple case of dollar averaging, is that the investor automatically does some selling of common stocks when the market advances substantially. In many of them, a very large rise in the market level would result in the sale of all common stock holdings. Others provided for retention of a minor proportion of equities under all circumstances. This approach had the double appeal of sounding logical and conservative, and of showing excellent results when applied retrospectively to the stock market over many years in the past. Unfortunately, its vogue grew greatest at the very time when it was destined to work least well. Many of the formula planners found themselves entirely or nearly out of the stock market at some level in the middle 1950s. True, they had realized excellent profits, but in a broad sense, the market ran away from them thereafter, and their formulas gave them little opportunity to buy back a common stock position. There is a similarity between the experience of those adopting the formula investing approach in the early